Before. But he didn't finish. Just go, he said. But as he did, he pulled me close, absorbing me in his arms. He was shaking. He'd broken out in a cold sweat. He didn't want me to go any more than I wanted to go. I knew that. And yet he thrust that suitcase into my fickle hand and pushed, actually pushed me through the door. As I carefully stepped over the broken glass on my way out, I looked back once, only once, to see him standing in the doorway, the knife hidden behind his back, his face bound in wistfulness and melancholy. He, too, was sad. I remember that the night was crisp, something only my brain perceived, not the rest of me. There was the knowledge that it was cold, like someone told me or something, but I never felt that it was cold, like I was sleepwalking or something in a dream. I could hear myself sobbing like I was watching it on TV, an observer, not a participant. I don't remember telling the driver, a short, shadowy man, nothing more than a muddled voice to me, a pair of eyes in the rearview mirror, where to take me. It was as if he knew. I got in the car and he sped off down the choppy street, driving fast and jerky, and I remember thinking that he must have heard Matthew say to hurry or something, because he was going so fast. Matthew must have told him. I clung to the door handle and braced myself for every turn, wondering if this is what it felt like when Mama died, when that Datsun Bluebird started spinning somersaults down the road. The building that the driver pulled up to was short and gray, the word Greyhound written across the brick in big blue letters. It was on the corner of some street, a city street that was all but abandoned at this time of night. Outside, an older woman stood with her sparse gray hair, puffing on a cigarette, her free hand thrust deep in the pocket of a flimsy coat. $17, the cab driver said with a grating voice. And sitting like a bird brain in the back seat of that cab, I asked, huh? He pointed to the stack of money in my trembling hand and said again, $17. And I counted out the fare from the cash Matthew had handed me, and carried that leather suitcase inside, watching the woman as I passed by. Spare some change? She said to me, but I folded up that money and squeezed it in my hand, real tight so she wouldn't see. Inside I found a vending machine, and the first thing I did was slip in a dollar and press the red button. A soda dropped down faster than expected, and I took it and sank sideways into the rows of empty chairs. Out the window it was still dark, the first whiff of daylight creeping up from the bottom of the sky. A grumpy old man sat behind the ticket booth, counting dollar bills into a register, grunting all the while he did so. I could hear a TV, though I didn't see it, the sound of early morning news, traffic, and the day's weather. I didn't know what I was doing here. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, where I was supposed to go. It hadn't sunk in yet, the fact that Joseph was dead. Tears clung to my cheeks, my eyes feeling fat and puffy from crying. My heart hadn't slowed its pace, a relentless gallop that made my head start to spin. Tucked beneath the sweatshirt, on a white undershirt, were splotches of blood that had spattered me when Matthew came tearing into my room. Joseph's blood. I was sure of it. I tried hard to piece the bits and pieces together. The broken glass, the knife, the guttural scream that awoke me from sleep, Matthew appearing in the door, his words, "Go now," before... Before what? I sat there and wondered. Before the police arrive. Before Isaac appeared. It had yet to really hit me. The fact that I was on my own. That I no longer belonged to Joseph. That he would no longer be coming into my room. I sat there for I don't know how long. Taking slow sips of my soda. Listening to the TV. It was warm in the bus station. And bright. I stared for some time at a fluorescent light flickering on the ceiling and watched as a man came into the station in jeans and a tattered T-shirt, a Husker's cap on his head. I thought that he should have been cold with just the T-shirt on, but he didn't look cold. He looked at me out of the corner of his eye, trying to make it seem as if he wasn't staring. But I could tell he was. He carried an overstuffed duffel bag in one hand, too much stuff inside to zip it clear shut. He nodded, kind of a half-nod, as if saying, "I see you," and then walked, smack dab, to a chart on the wall, and when he got there, he just stood and stared. I saw the words on the wall above that chart, departures, arrivals, the bus schedule. I waited until he purchased a ticket to Chicago from the grumpy man behind the booth, and then sulked into a hard chair on the other side of the station, and pulled that cap over his eyes and appeared to sleep. I slid from my chair, wiping my eyes with the back of a sleeve, and wandered to that chart on the wall, staring at so many words and numbers it made me dizzy. Kearney, Columbus, Chicago, Cincinnati. And then I saw it. Two words so unexpected I knew they were meant to be. Fort Collins. Fort Collins. The same words that I'd seen time and again on the return address labels of those letters Big Lily sent me from her home in Colorado. My Lily, little Lily, lived in Fort Collins, Colorado. It was time to go to her, to see my sister again.
Heidi. Graham stands 3 feet away in the darkened room, watching with gluttonous eyes as I lower my undergarments to the ground, the pale pink bra falling upon the kitten heels and pink panties, beside sheer nylons now wadded into a ball and cast aside. His eyes look me up and down deliberately, unhurriedly, coming to a standstill on the diagonal scar, red and ever-present, running from my belly button down, its tail end lost amid pubic hairs. A constant reminder. I dismiss that scar, telling myself it simply isn't true. Reminding myself of the baby, sound asleep on the pink fleece blanket next door. Graham says nothing as his warm hands come to rest on my waistline, and he leads me to the bed, setting me down on a gray duvet that slips halfway to the bedroom floor, beside pillows that have yet to be replaced since morning. I stare past him, at a ceiling fan, brushed nickel with cherry blades, blowing papers one by one from a dresser and onto the floor, Graham's latest work in progress. Though he's so caught up in the moment, he fails to notice. Fails to notice how the breeze of the ceiling fan spawns goose flesh upon my bare arms, my legs, my chest. He stands at the end of the bed, slipping an undershirt up over his head, and as he does so, as I lean in to run my hands down the oblique and abdominal muscles that line his torso, the faint fair hair, the alcove of a belly button, the antique brass button that affixes his jeans, I hear it. I hear the baby cry. Louder than the blare of a car horn, an unexpected peal of thunder, the roar of a steam engine. I stand up quickly, gathering my clothing from the bedroom, the living room floor. Graham, deaf to the baby's cries, begs me not to leave. Heidi, he says, his voice placating in a way that I bet makes it impossible for women to say no. What's wrong? His eyes stare at me, at my eyes, as I step into the dress, clinging to the nylons, the panties in my hand. I secure the buttons up my back. Mismatched and irregular. It's just, I say, feeling flushed, unable to let go of the sensation of Graham's hands, his eyes on my body, staring at me in a way Chris no longer stares. I forgot there was something I needed to do. I hear the crying when I am still in Graham's doorway, loud, wretched crying, and I begin to run. The frantic clamor of kitten heels pounding on a wooden floor as Graham calls to me by name, Heidi! But he doesn't follow. When I come into my home, there she is, the baby, sprawled across a pink blanket on the floor, sound asleep. It is not what I imagined. What I expected to find was the blanket folded over her like the edges of an omelet, a handful of fleece stuffed in her angry hand, her skin cardinal red, her cry thorny like goosegrass, rasping, scratchy, as if she's been crying for days, weeks, more. Instead, she is silent, save for the delicate inhalation and exhalation of air. She lies inert on the pink blanket, her features calm and composed, while I stand there in the doorway, gasping for breath. She is asleep, I tell myself, finding it utterly impossible, for I was certain as I live and breathe, that I heard a baby cry. I run to the child and sweep her tiny figure from the floor, up into my arms, waking her from her daze. "There now," I croon quietly into her ear. "Mommy is here. Mommy won't ever leave you again."
Willow. Matthew had given me near everything I could possibly need inside that suitcase. Money, and lots of it. Some food, candy bars and granola bars and cookies. I didn't know for sure how he happened upon the money. I settled into the bus, clutching it close to me, the only possession in the world that was mine. As the bus crisscrossed rural Nebraska, the sun making its ascent into the late winter sky, I laid it upon my rickety lap and opened the clasp to reveal a book, like all those he'd slipped into my bedroom when I was a kid. The 50 States. I skimmed through it, seeing that he'd left messages for me in messy black ink, smudged between the slippery pages of the thick book. Beside Alaska, too cold. Nebraska, no way. Illinois, maybe. A guidebook to my future. That was Matthew's intent. Montana, a good place to hide. I wondered if that was what I needed to do, find a place to hide. Would someone be looking for me? Joseph, maybe, or maybe the police? No, I reminded myself. Not Joseph. Joseph was dead. I closed my eyes and tried to sleep, but sleep didn't come easily. All I could see were Matthew's deranged eyes as he tore into my room, the watery blood, colorless in the darkness of the room, on the knife. I heard Joseph scream over and over again, a ringing in my ears, and tried hard not to imagine what had happened when I left, to wonder where Matthew was right then and there, and whether or not he was okay. I had this suspicion that everyone was looking at me, that everyone knew. I sunk low into the seat and tried to hide, refusing to make eye contact with anyone, refusing to force out a stale hello, even to the man who sat on the other side of the aisle, in his own teal chair, in a black suit and clerical collar, leafing through a worn copy of the Bible. Especially not the man on the other side of the aisle. I closed my eyes and tried hard to pretend that he wasn't there, that he couldn't detect my sins, sniff them out like a bloodhound on a scent trail. Sometime after noon, I started to recognize the scenery out that tinted window. Gigantic green signs with town names I knew, their names written in bold white letters, North Platte and Sutherland and Roscoe. A plaque lining the road, entering Keith County. Familiar whitewashed barns and cattle fencing, an abandoned wooden farmhouse sloping so far in one direction I was certain even 8 years ago, the last time I laid eyes on it, it would slide right over onto the yellowing grass and collapse. I found myself sitting upright, my nose pressed to the frigid glass, hearing Mama's voice against the drone of the bus's engine. "I love you like pigs love slop." And then that bus veered off the road toward Highway 61, signs leading the way to Lake McConaughey, where I built many a sandcastle as a kid. Mama waking up with the urge to go on the brightest of summer days and loading Lily and me into the Bluebird for the short drive to the lake. She never remembered the sunscreen, and we always burned to a crisp, all of us, comparing freckles and pink noses later in the day, pressing on the tips of our noses until they turned white. I stared out the window while that bus pulled right on into the Conoco parking lot, right there beside the Super 8 and the Comfort Inn, just across from the Wendy's where Mama and I ate so long ago it was like another life. The Pomito was there and the truck stop, just like I remembered. I remembered it all. The bus was passing through Ogallala on the way to Fort Collins. This was Ogallala. I was home. When the bus came to a stop and passengers unloaded and headed into the Conoco to use the restroom and grab a snack, I had the strongest urge to snatch that suitcase and run. My heart was thumping loud and heavy in my chest, arms and hands quivering. I went so far as to push past the handful of new riders who were boarding the bus for the next leg of the trip. "Excuse me, and pardon me," I muttered as I pushed the suitcase ahead of me, lumbering down the narrow aisle in a clumsy manner. I got more than one dirty look. A girl with longish hair the color of pralines parroted, "Excuse you," as I passed by too close, stepping on her fancy shoe. But I didn't care. I convinced myself that I had the tiniest inkling how to get home, to the prefab house, though chances were good I didn't know how to do it when I was 8 years old. But it didn't matter. I could have laid down in a roadside ditch somewhere in Ogallala, and it still would have felt like home. I could feel it in my blood and in my pores. Ogallala. Home. And wrapped up in all that, Mama and Daddy. There was this silly thought filling my mind. Maybe Mama was still here. Maybe it was just a whole big misunderstanding. I'd walk back to the prefab home, and there Mama would be with Daddy and baby Lily, who was not Rose, who did not have a sister who was not me. And all of a sudden, walking through the rasping screen door, I'd be 8 years old again, and it would be as if time hadn't happened. Time had stood still. Mama was alive, her energy and enthusiasm filling the flavorless rooms of that tiny home as it used to do. The house would be exactly the same as we'd left it. There would be no other family living there, no little girl sleeping in my bed, and I'd never have heard of a man named Joseph. Just a mistake, I told myself as I climbed down those enormous bus steps and onto the Canoco parking lot. The cold air startled me. Begged me to change my mind, but I ignored it. I started off across the parking lot toward the street, a look of defiance streaked across my face. A refusal to believe what I knew inside me to be true. Just a whole big misunderstanding. Mama is alive. Daddy is alive. My feet pounded on the pavement fast and determined. The suitcase was awkward, smacking my right leg with each and every step I took. What I found out was that I did remember how to get to that prefab house. Maybe my mind didn't know, but my feet certainly did, because they carried me right on out of that parking lot, down Prospector Drive. The suitcase didn't bother me, nor did the blustery air. I was on autopilot, or cruise control, as Daddy used to say about driving the truck when I asked how come he didn't get tired with all that driving. My mind was stuck on Mama, and this expectation that she was still alive as I trudged past the old brick buildings I remembered from when I was a kid, under leafless trees that spotted first, second, third, and fourth streets, beside the carbon copy white homes and low-lying telephone wires. In time, the trees and the homes began to multiply, the small, nearly deserted town drifting away, and then onto Spruce Street, with its mobile homes and open land and billboards, nearly a mile's walk with cars soaring by at speeds that made the hair whirl around my head. My legs burned by the time I arrived at Canyon Drive. My fingers were numb, my nose oozing snot from its snares. My arm was nearly asleep from the weight of the suitcase, my leg likely lacerated from where it rubbed back and forth all along the way. The house was smaller than I remembered, the white siding more like oatmeal than snow. What once felt like an entire stairwell to the front door were instead only four small crooked steps, the aluminum handrail missing half its winding, taupe, spindles. There was a basketball net, which there never used to be, a Honda hatchback in the drive, red, not the bluebird I was used to seeing. I stood on the opposite side of Canyon Drive, staring at that house that used to be mine, gathering the courage to turn the knob on the front door, hoping and praying I'd find Mama on the other side. Though, of course, deep down, somewhere far inside, I knew she was dead. But I tried hard to ignore that notion, to imagine the what-if instead. There was a split-second thought. If I didn't try, I'd never know. And that was a good thing, because not knowing was better than proof that Mama and Daddy were dead. I'd been 8 years old. A stupid kid, after all. Maybe all those things they told me had been a lie, just one of all the other lies Joseph told me. I made believe Mama had been searching for me all this time, that my face had been like one of those other missing kids they plaster on the back of milk cartons, the black-and-white images with an age-progressed photo beside it, what some smarty-pants thought I might look like when I was 16. If you think you have seen Claire, please call 1-800-I-AM-LOST. I imagined the wording. Claire was last seen at her home on Canyon Drive in Ogallala, Nebraska. Her hair is the color of snot, her eyes a bizarre blue. She has a small scar under her chin, a space between her two front teeth. She was last seen wearing... What was I wearing? That night Amber Adler came to tell me my parents were dead. That periwinkle t-shirt I used to own, the one with the bright red tube of lipstick and the frisky inscription, S-W-A-K, kiss marks flecking its edges. Or maybe a party dress or a polka dot tank top, or maybe... This is what I'm thinking about when the door to that prefab home jolts open, the sound of kids arguing annihilating the silence, the sound of a mother's voice, not my mother, but a mother, stern and tired, telling them to shut their mouths, please. There they were, three of them, no, four, I saw then, the mother carrying an infant in a seat in her arms, pouncing down those four crooked steps like a litter of playful kittens. The two freestanding children elbowed one another all the way down the stairs, calling each other names, Fartface and Booger Brain. It was two boys, each in jeans and tennis shoes, thick winter coats and fur bomber hats. The mother had a blanket, pink, draped over that baby, a girl. Maybe the girl she always wanted, I thought, as the mother propelled the boys forward with a gentle shove and told them to hurry. Get in the car. They were going to be late. One of the boys spun then, suddenly crying huge crocodile tears.
You hit me!
He screamed at his mother. Daniel, she said, her tone flat. Get in the car. But he continued his outburst right there, at the bottom of the steps, as the older boy climbed into the hatchback as he was told, and the mother secured the baby carrier into the car. The boy, Daniel, maybe 5 or 6 years old, crossed his arms across himself and pouted, that bottom lip of his almost covering the top one. I stared in awe, thinking how I never, ever would have talked to Mama that way. Never would have called Lily a fart face or booger brain. I decided then and there that I didn't like this little boy. Not one bit at all. I didn't like the way his wayward brown hair crept from the edges of his bomber hat, or the way his too big coat hung farther down on the left side than the right, the sleeve on the left completely covering a gloved hand. I didn't like his navy blue boots or the nasty frown on his long face. But what really bothered me was that he thought whatever errand they were about to run was the worst thing in the world that could happen. Clearly, he'd never met a man like Joseph. What I wouldn't give for a trip to the Safeway right then and there. I thought about helping Mama push the shopping cart around and tickling Lily's little piggies so she wouldn't fuss. I remembered the heavenly scent of fresh baked donuts in the bakery's display case, the way Mama would tell me to pick one for each of us for the next day's breakfast. There I was, picturing cake donuts oozing with rainbow-covered sprinkles, long johns coated with chocolate icing, when that lady started toward me, and instinctively my feet began a retreat. "Can I help you?" she asked, coming down the driveway to where I stood on the opposite side of the street, staring at her family. Her eyes, brown and runny, lined with bags, were tired, her hair slick, as though she hadn't found the time for a shower that day. "Are you lost, honey?" And things came at me quickly, things I hadn't seen before. The green shamrocks taped to the windows of the home, shamrocks we never used to own. The black lettering on the mailbox, Brigman. A dog barking from the front window, big, like a German shepherd, its head poking through lacy curtains that were never there. A wooden rocking chair on the tiny front porch, a gnome holding a welcome sign. That boy with the ugly pout on his face, or the older one, who now re-emerged from the car to see who the heck his mother was talking to, who walked down the drive to meet his mother, who asked again, "Is there something I can help you with?" as I turned around and began to run. This was not my home. The realization stole the breath right from my lungs, and I found myself gasping for air as I tore down Canyon Drive. Past parked cars and fenced-in yards, mailboxes and splotchy lawns, kicking the gravel up from the street as I ran. The The world spun in hurried circles. I cut through a lawn in case that woman in her red hatchback, Mrs. Brigman, tried to follow. I tripped over a boulder and landed splat on the ground in the back of some stranger's yard. The knees of my pants were soaking wet, muddy from the melting snow. The suitcase fell open and emptied itself onto the soggy lawn, the books and dollar bills peppering the snow. I grabbed quickly, stuffing my belongings back into place before slamming the suitcase closed. I didn't see it right away. In fact, I almost didn't see it at all. I was standing up, hoping and praying someone wasn't at the back window of that home watching me, when something, bright in the otherwise white snow, caught my eye, and I reached down and picked it up. And there, in my hand, was a photo of Mama. The very same one Joseph had years ago forced me to tear to shreds. That photo Joseph made me march down the steps of the Omaha home and throw into the trash. I remember that day, Matthew and Isaac sitting at the table watching me, watching as I dropped the hundreds of pieces of Mama into the garbage can before I walked upstairs, like Joseph had told me to do, to pray. Pray for God's forgiveness. Matthew had pulled those pieces from the garbage can and, like a jigsaw puzzle, taped them back together. A million pieces of scotch tape lined the back of that picture, making it thick and sturdy, white, ragged creases lining Mama's beautiful face, her long black hair, her sapphire eyes. I held Mama in my hands, there in her peridot-colored dress, a frock, as Mama used to call it. The bateau neckline and cap sleeve seamed by Joseph's poisonous hand. Where had Matthew kept it all those years since he pulled it from the trash? Why had he kept it from me for so long? But of course, I knew why. He was worried Joseph would see. But he didn't have to worry anymore. It had been years since I'd seen Mama. In my mind, the black hair had dissolved, the blue eyes had become diluted, like a watered-down can of pop. Her smile had shrunk to half its size, and only sometimes did I remember she wore bright red lipstick on the days when Daddy was home. But there she was, the pitch-black hair and sapphire eyes, Berry Bliss lipstick smoothed on her lips, and she was laughing. I could hear it, the laughter from that photograph, and I could see Mama, just seconds after I'd snapped that crooked photo, snatched the camera from my hand and take a shot of me. And after we'd developed the role at the Safeway, we each held on to the photo of the other, so we'd always be together, even when we weren't together. "I love you like exes love O's," she'd said, planting a big red kiss on my cheek, and I'd stared at that kiss in the rearview mirror of the old Datsun Bluebird, refusing to wipe my cheek clean. I pressed that photo of Mama to my heart and knew then, bawling my eyes out in the backyard of some stranger's home, on my knees in the vanishing March snow, that Mama was there, even if she wasn't there. Mama would never, ever, ever in a million years leave me.
Heidi. I press my baby into me and sink into the rocking chair, vowing never, ever, ever to leave her again. She's begun to cry now. Her cry angry and infuriated as she seizes strands of my hair in the palm of her hand and pulls, hard, howling without cease, the kind of cry that forces the breath from her lungs, and she finds herself gasping suddenly for air. I rise from the chair and begin to tread throughout the room, aware of the murmur of Nina Simone that seeps through the wall from Graham's home. "I put a spell on you," playing louder now than ever before. Or is that simply my imagination? Is he trying to drown out the sound of my baby's indignant cry, or send me a message? I envision Graham, at that moment, still unclad, wondering why it was I had to leave when I'd only just arrived. And then I think, what would he do, there in his home with his undershirt discarded, his jeans unzipped? Would he phone a lady friend to fill the space where I'd just been? I try not to think about it, to think about some beautiful blonde woman taking my place on the edge of the unmade bed, And Graham, blind to the change, aware only of some woman's hands on him. I will the image out of my mind. Me on Graham's bed, his body hovering above mine. I think what I would have done, how far I would have gone had it not been for the baby. But no, I remind myself. The baby was asleep. Or was she? I wonder, finding myself suddenly oh so confused, mindful of the cry, desperate and helpless, completely forlorn, that I heard from Graham's room. That cry plays over and over again in my mind, a soundtrack to accompany the scene. Graham slipping an undershirt up over his head, the oblique and abdominal muscles, the faint fair hair, the brass button of his jeans. And then, that cry. The baby did cry, I tell myself. She was not asleep. I move the baby back and forth, up and down in a gentle seesaw motion, anything to calm her down. She's angry with me for leaving. I say it over and over again. I'm so sorry. Mommy will never, ever leave you again. And I smother her with kisses in a weak attempt at an apology. I am not a good mother, I tell myself. A good mother wouldn't have left her alone and walked out of the room. A moment of weakness, I think, remembering all too well the condom abandoned in the pocket of Chris's trousers. And the thought of it, the thought of that shiny blue wrapper, sends me into a rapid descent. Heartbeat unsettled, hands that feel like sludge. In the kitchen, I prepare a bottle, knowing, as I always do, as the baby nuzzles her nose into the black crepe dress, that she is hungry. I set the formula into the bottle, add water, and shake. A counterfeit reproduction of the sustenance her mother is meant to provide. I try to remember why it was that I decided to bottle feed my baby, why I did not breastfeed, or did I breastfeed? And I find that standing there in the kitchen, I cannot remember. Cancer, I tell myself. But then, cancer? Or was that, the cancer, simply a figment of my imagination? And I wonder about that line on my abdomen. The very one Graham traced with a fingertip. The one he almost asked about until I pressed my fingers to my lips and whispered, shh, and wonder where it came from, that scar. Whether or not it's a scar at all. And then a word settles in my mind, ugly and vile, and I shake my head post-haste to get it out. Abortion. But no. I press the baby into me, knowing that can't be true. That doctor with the balding head said that she, my Juliet, had been discarded as medical waste. He said that medical waste is incinerated after leaving the hospital. And I was left with a vision that kept me awake for years on end, that filled my dreams with dread. Baby Juliet in a 2,000-degree kiln, being tossed around like cement in a cement mixer so that all sides of her were exposed to the heat, her tiny soul escaping as gas into the Earth's atmosphere. I shake my head again, vehemently, and say out loud, no. I peer down at the baby in my arms and think, Juliet is here. She is safe. Perhaps it's a birthmark, I think then, that scar on my abdomen, like the one on my baby's leg. Do such things, birthmarks, pass from generation to generation? I think back to the day before, chatting with patrons on the L train en route to lunch with Chris in the Chicago Loop, as they complimented my adorable baby and said how much alike we looked, my baby and me. Those words every mother in the world longs to hear. She has your eyes, one said, and another, she has your smile. And as they did, I traced a finger over the curve of the baby's upper lip, that prominent V in the middle that is somehow said to resemble the bow of Cupid. Just like Zoe's. Just like mine. It runs in the family, I'd said, of that resplendent smile my baby revealed at the appropriate time, as if she'd known all along that she was the topic of conversation, the one who everyone was staring at, ogling. But she's mine, I thought, pressing her close to me, refusing to think about Willow, pushing the name Ruby far from my mind. All mine. And then there's the buzz of the intercom, pulling me from my thoughts. It's loud and incredibly rude as I set that fraudulent breast milk into my baby's mouth. And whether it's the milk itself or the blare of the intercom, I honestly can't say. But the baby thrusts the bottle out with a tongue and again begins to scream. I walk to the window and peer out, onto the street below, to see Jennifer. My best friend, Jennifer, standing by the plate glass door with a cup of Starbucks coffee in each hand. Dressed in hospital scrubs and a jean jacket, her hair blowing in the incessant Chicago wind. I duck frantically down before she can see me. Before she can see me standing by the bay window eyeing her, and hoping that she will leave. I cannot see Jennifer now. She will stare at my dress, the buttons mismatched, the dark makeup, laden with a decided desperation, now running its course down my cheek. The pink panties and nylons in a ball, the black heels once again pulled from their cardboard box in vain. And she will want to know what happened. She will ask about Graham. She will ask about my baby. And what will I say? How will I explain? The intercom buzzes again, and I rise to my knees, clutching a screaming baby in my arms, peering out of the bay window to see Jennifer, blocking the sun from her eyes with the back of a hand, peering upward to the window that she knows is mine. And I plunge again to the ground, uncertain as to whether or not she saw me there in the window, eyeing her from up above. I all but drop the baby on the ground, as the two of us hover together, in the mere 24 inches of space beneath the window sill. Shh! I beg the baby with a despair in my voice that mimics her own. Hush, please! I say, as my knees begin to ache. My phone is ringing, and I know, without having to look at the display screen, that it is Jennifer, wondering where I am. She's been told I'm sick, for sure. And if and when she called the office to see if I was there, Dana, receptionist extraordinaire, told her of my unrelenting flu. And my best friend has come to deliver coffee, or perhaps an Earl Grey tea to make me feel well. And here I am, hiding from her, on my knees on the hardwood floor, begging the child to be still, to be quiet. And then the phone settles and the intercom settles, and with the exception of the baby, all is quiet. I rise cautiously from my knees to see that Jennifer is gone, out of sight, here 1 minute, gone the next. I search down the block for the faded denim of a jean jacket, but spy only my neighbor, an older lady from down the hall toting an empty granny cart en route to the grocery store. I exhale deeply, certain I'm off the hook, and plead with my baby to drink the bottle, as I set it warily on her tongue and will her to drink. Please, honey, I say, or attempt to say, before a knock at the door makes me jump right out of my skin. The knock is light, and yet knowing and determined. Jennifer, I'm certain, who slipped through the plate glass door with her Starbucks cups when old Mrs. Green left for the grocery store. Sneaky, sneaky, I think as I hear her calling me through the door. Heidi, she says. And then there's that knock again, that damn tap, 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 which speaks louder than any words possibly can. She knows I am here. Heidi, she says again, as I begin to run through the home with the baby in my arms, as far away from the door as I can possibly go. I imagine we're being trailed by carbon monoxide and must find a place where we can breathe. Jennifer's voice is diluted by the distance as I hover in the corner of Chris's in my bedroom, tilting the blinds upward so those who come and go on the city street down below will not see me. And yet I'm certain I hear her utter, "I saw you, and I know you're there," from where she stands in the hall, tap, tap, tapping on the wooden pane of the door for my attention. They will take my baby. They will take my baby from me. I beg, "Please, Juliet, please be quiet." Panic-stricken that she won't take the bottle, that she won't stop crying. That word, Juliet, it slips from my tongue. Utterly wrong and yet so undeniably right. But the crying won't stop. I'm with baby Zoe all over again, in the midst of an episode of colic, and she's screaming, writhing in pain. But with Zoe, I don't remember the need to hide, to crouch on my bedroom floor and hide. How long we wait, I cannot say. 1 minute, 1 hour, I don't know. But I jostle my baby silently and beg her to stop. The frequency of Jennifer's tap-tap-tapping gets less and less until it altogether ceases. My phone rings and then stops. Rings and then stops. The house phone. The cell phone. I watch out the bedroom window with its upward slanting blinds as Jennifer appears, turning circles on the street below as if utterly confused. She peers up at the bay window in our living room and stares. And it's only as she departs down the street, tossing one of the Starbucks cups in a nearby garbage bin, that I emerge from the bedroom and seek out my phone, the one which, from the hallway, Jennifer most certainly heard ring. 3 times, or so the phone tells me. 3 missed calls. An awaiting voicemail. A text message. "Where are you?"
Willow. Luis Flores beckons me again. A guard arrives at the cell I share with Diva, demanding I put my hands through the portal so she can cuff them before she opens the door. I climb down from the top tier of the bunk bed and place my hands behind my back. We walk through the prison together. Today Ms. Flores wants to talk about the baby Calla. I sit down across from her on a spent seat with its inflexible back. "Why did you take the baby?" she asks, and I picture that night, standing in the darkened woods, staring through the treasure trove of windows of the A-frame home. After visiting the old prefab home in Ogallala, I found my way back to the Canoco, where I begged and pleaded with the ticket lady to trade my obsolete ticket in for a new one. I'd missed the bus to Fort Collins, of course. For $20, she said she would. Grudgingly. It was dark by then. The next bus wouldn't arrive until the middle of the night, 3:05 a.m. But I hadn't gone to the Canoco right away. After I'd stopped sniveling in that stranger's yard, I made my way over to the cemetery off 5th Street and laid down on the lawn, right between Mama and Daddy. And then I got myself together and did what needed to be done. Every single light in the A-frame must have been turned on. I saw everything as if I was in that house with them all, a fly on the wall. I saw Paul Zeger in an upstairs room slipping off a tie, Big Lily cradling that gosh darn baby in her arms, rocking her back and forth in a subliminal sway, her hand sweeping across the baby's stupid head. The dog at her feet began a happy dance, and when Big Lily meandered to the back door to let it outside, I hid behind an enormous tree. "Go, Tyson," she said with a slight kick to his behind. "Hurry up." And then she closed the door, and that dog, with its amazing snout, sought me out in the trees and licked me. I pushed it away, whispered, "Go," in whatever firm voice I could muster, letting my eyes run their course through the home. The fireplace was on, a TV in the Zeger bedroom where Paul now lay spread out across the bed. Tuned into the news. And then there was Lily. Little Lily. My Lily. In a bedroom all alone, braiding the hair of a baby doll. She sat on the edge of a purple bed with that doll pressed between her legs, winding the strands around her fingers. My Lily wasn't a baby anymore. In fact, she was older than I'd been when Mama and Daddy died. And she was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Just like Mama had been.
"Why didn't you just take Rose?"
Ms. Flores asks as she breaks off a bite of muffin and sets it in her mouth, letting it slowly dissolve.
"Rose was your sister, after all."
"Lily," I snap. "Her name is Lily," I say, imagining the way she tired of braiding the doll's hair. Maybe she didn't know how to do it. Or maybe she was just tired of playing with the doll. I don't know. But I saw the way she spun that doll around and stared into her acrylic eyes for a split second before she flung it across the room. The doll's head smashed into the purple wall and fell like a brick from the sky. At the same time, Paul and Big Lily jumped, but it was Big Lily, beckoned by the sound of My Lily's cry, who placed the baby in a cradle and climbed the steps to My Lily's room. Lily hated baby Calla. That's what I told myself. And she was taking it out on that doll. I watched as she rose from the bed in a horse-print nightgown and plaid slippers and walked to where that toy lay face down on the ground and kicked it with a vengeance. Ms. Flores stares at me and then gives in, sort of.
"Fine," she says. "Lily. Rose. Whatever. Answer the question, Claire. Why didn't you take your sister instead of the baby?"
The truth was that my Lily had a grand life. Before Paul and Big Lily decided to replace her with the baby they always dreamed of. There wasn't a thing I could give my Lily. My only possessions in the entire world were stuffed inside a suitcase Matthew had given me. Dollar bills that were quickly dwindling away. A couple of books. The photograph of Mama. "I couldn't take care of Lily," I tell Ms. Flores. "If I took her from that home."
"But you could take care of the baby? You could take care of Calla?"
I shrug and say weakly, "That's not what I meant."
"Then what did you mean, Claire?"
She condemns, her lips thin, her eyebrows puckered. She removes her glasses and sets them on the table. My Lily could have that life again. The one with beach vacations and pink and mint green bikes and Montessori schools. I just needed to fix things. And so when Big Lily climbed up those steps and Paul rolled over onto his side and pretended he couldn't hear the outburst my Lily was having, I let myself into the A-frame home, through a back door that had been left unlocked when the Cocker Spaniel was let outside to pee. I slipped my hands under that sleeping baby's pink blanket and lifted her from the cradle, careful of her head like Mama always told me when Lily was a baby. And with that baby in tow, I walked out the wooden patio door and into the starless March night.
Chris. I oversleep. When I finally do wake up, the hangover is immense. A splitting headache, the despotic sunlight blinding my eyes. I wake up to the impatient sound of my cell phone ringing, the tone, in my alcohol-induced state, out of place, jarring. Henry. His voice on the other end of the line, like a drill sergeant's calling out orders. "Where the hell are you?" he asks. It's after 9. I don't have time to shower. I reek of tequila as I wait for the elevator at the end of the hall, my hair still smelling of rancid cigarette smoke from some bar I wandered to last night. My eyes are bloodshot, my hands still clammy. I forget my notes. The ones that tell me what I'm supposed to say to the group of potential investors awaiting me in the 8th floor conference room. The ones we're hoping to impress. As I slink into the conference room, all eyes are on me. I taste alcohol on my breath, stomach churning in the morning light. Gastric acid propels upward and into my mouth before I choke on it, forcing it back down.
"Better late than never,"
Henry slurs beneath his breath, as I wipe my mouth on the back of a sleeve. I catch sight of Cassidy, leaned in close to some venture capitalist named Ted. She's got her lips pressed so close to his ear, I can imagine the way he feels her breath, the tingle of it on his skin. He turns to look at her all at once, and together they laugh in unison, laughter that I'm sure is at my expense. I run my fingers through my hair. At some point, Tom pulls me aside, tells me to get it together. He hands me a mug of coffee, as if the caffeine might change things, make my speech less slurred, my thoughts crystal clear. I dig into the depths of my briefcase for financial documents which are nowhere. I yank crumbled notes, memos, out instead. The purple sticky note with the sole word, yes. The coffee settles me, some. We take a mid-morning break, and I return to my room to change my clothes, comb my hair. I find the missing financial documents strewn upon a table and place them in my briefcase. I brush my teeth. Between the caffeine and the toothpaste, the taste of alcohol begins to slowly ebb away. I all but overdose on pain medication for the splitting headache. When I return, Cassidy and Ted are sharing a bagel with cream cheese from a single plate. They're leaned in close together. She licks her fingers with an overzealous tongue and leans in close to whisper something to him. Their eyes turn to mine, and again they laugh. I imagine Cassidy in my hotel room, unbuttoning the buttons of a starch white tunic so that I will stay. And I imagine me forcing on a pair of loafers and running through the door. I imagine that she left that hotel room and sought out Ted. Ted, a 40-something venture capitalist with a tungsten wedding band on his left hand. Based on the looks of things, he, unlike me, didn't turn her away. He let her unbutton that blouse. Let her reveal what was hidden beneath. I hear Heidi in my head. Hear her chant, Femme Fatale, over and over again in my head. A rallying cry. Women unite! I wonder about Ted's wife. I wonder if she's pretty. I wonder if they have kids. I'm not in the least bit let down. More than anything, I'm relieved, seeing now that Cassidy would have chosen any member of the male species to keep her company for the night. I'm grateful that it wasn't me, because then I'd be the one sitting like an ass at the conference table, drooling all over a bagel with cream cheese, watching the way her tongue wraps its way around a finger as she licks it clean. When my phone rings, I find it in my pocket and see on the display screen Martin Miller, the PI I hired to track our Willow down. I hurry, quickly, from the conference room and into the hallway, an eighth-floor balcony that looks down into the hotel's atrium below, filled with banquet tables and plush sofas, tropical flowers and fish, dozens of big fat koi that swim in ponds throughout the atrium. Martin's voice is reticent. He's found something. I lay my hand on the balcony rail to steady myself, staring down on eight floors of nothingness that, when combined with the after effects of too much alcohol, make me woozy. What is it? I ask, my voice discomposed. The koi, eight floors below, are little more than white and orange smudges in the water. Martin says that he's emailing me a newspaper article he found, dated the middle of March. There's no mention of a willow or a ruby, but he says it might just be our girl. I wait for the email to come through on my phone, my limbs numb by the time my phone vibrates the email's arrival. I open the article, and there, staring me in the eye, is Willow Greer. Except that she's not Willow Greer. The caption reads, Claire Dalloway, wanted for questioning in the death of an Omaha man and his wife, and for the kidnapping of an infant girl abducted March 16th from her home in Fort Collins, Colorado. I skim the article and see that this Claire Dalloway may be armed, dangerous, that this man and his wife, Joseph and Miriam Abrahamson, were stabbed to death in their Omaha home while they slept. I read about the baby, Calla Zeger, born to a lady named Lily and a man named Paul, in Fort Collins, Colorado. There are identifying features, the color of her eyes, the shade of her sparse hair, a close-up of a birthmark on the back of a leg. A port wine stain, the article states, shaped like the state of Alaska. there is a reward for her return. I read about Joseph and Miriam Abrahamson, Miss Dalloway's foster family, who graciously welcomed Claire into their home upon the death of her own parents when she was 8 years old. I read about how they were murdered in their beds while they slept. The Abrahamsons have boys as well, Martin is telling me. Two sons, two biological sons, he adds. Isaac and Matthew, both in their 20s. The oldest son, Isaac, has an alibi for the night in question. He works the third shift, stacking shelves at Walmart. He came home early in the morning of March 19th to find his parents dead, in bed. The other son, Matthew Abrahamson, is on the run, like Claire Dalloway, wanted for questioning in the murder. You didn't tell anyone, did you, Martin? I ask, desperately. No, Chris, of course not. But we'll need to, he says. We'll need to turn your girl in. If she's the one, he says. And I think, of course. Of course we do. 24 hours, I beg. Just give me 24 hours. And he says, okay. I need to get to Heidi myself. I need to be the one to tell her. I wonder if he means it. If Martin really will give me 24 hours before he phones the police. There is a reward, I reread, for her return. Good God, I think, telling Martin that I have to go. I must call Heidi. I must warn her. I dial the numbers, press send. The phone rings and rings, but there is no answer. My eyes reread the words. Armed, dangerous, stabbed, death.
Willow. The bus ride to Chicago was long, over 23 hours to be exact, with some 16 stops. Twice we had to gather all our belongings and move to a different bus, one that was going the same way as us. I saw more of the world than I'd ever seen, the mountains of Colorado that shrunk as we crossed the state and became near nothingness, only cattle farm after cattle farm with so many cows jam-packed inside. It made me claustrophobic just looking at them all, fighting for food from the trough. We retraced our steps through Nebraska, crossed over the Missouri River, and were welcomed to Iowa by the people of the state, or so the sign on the side of the road said. I chose Chicago because of Mama. There I was, staring at another big chart on the bus station wall. Arrivals and departures, it said. And I saw that word, Chicago, and thought of Mama and her list of one days, and how she didn't get to cross too much off that list before the bluebird went tumbling down the road. I didn't see Switzerland on that list, nor did I see Paris, but I did see Chicago. And I thought of that magnificent mile Mama longed to see, the one with the Gucci and Prada stores where she wanted to shop. I thought that if Mama couldn't see it for herself, then I'd see it for her. The baby slept peacefully, wrapped up in the soft pink blanket on my lap. I didn't dare set her or the suitcase down, and so the three of us, we shared one seat. She slept much of the time, but when her eyes were open, I held her so she could see through the window, first the sunset, and later the sunrise over the gateway to the west, a city that used to be my home. At some gas station stop at a town called Brush, I lugged the baby and suitcase inside and purchased formula, like Mama used to feed Lily, in a plastic bottle. When the baby finally did fuss at some point in the night, I thrust that bottle in her mouth and watched her suck herself back to sleep. I didn't think much about the baby being cute or the way she wrapped her tiny hand around my finger and squeezed. I wasn't thinking about how her eyes watched me or the words little sister scrawled across her shirt. What I was thinking about were those sea anemones, the ones in a book Matthew had brought for me when I was a kid. Would-be murderers in delicate, angelic bodies. I thought of their wispy tentacles when the baby twined her hand around my finger. I considered their brilliant colors when the baby looked at me and beamed. They looked like flowers, but they were not. Instead, they were predators of the sea, immortal, injecting paralyzing venom into their prey so they could eat them alive. This baby was a sea anemone. I thought that I hated her. I did. But as the bus drifted across the country, and the baby held tight to my little finger, and from time to time just stared at me or smiled. I had to remind myself that she was evil, as if that thought just kept slipping from my mind. I told myself I wasn't going to like her. Not one bit.